I call the Agriculture, Finance, and Policy Committee meeting to order on Thursday, March 9th, 2023. There is a quorum present. We'll do the approval of minutes first. Vice Chair Purcell, may I have a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved, Madam Chair.
All right, Representative Purcell moves the approval of minutes for March 7th, 2023. Any discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say no. The motion prevails, and the minutes for March 7th, 2023 are approved. The first bill that we have on our agenda is House File 1497. Vice Chair Purcell, whenever you're ready, please move your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move House File 1497 before the committee.
All right. To your bill, Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm presenting House File 1497 today, and I remember quite vividly back in 2014 when Home Depot was making national news for selling plants that spring at their locations across the country labeled as pollinator-friendly after they had been treated with neonicotinoid pesticides at levels that could be harmful or lethal to bees and other garden variety insects. A study released by Friends of the Earth and Pesticide Research Institute called Gardeners Beware 2014 showed that 51% of garden plants purchased at Lowe's, Home Depot, and Walmart across 18 cities in the U.S. and Canada contained these neonicotinoids that have been proven to be harmful for beneficial insects who may be attracted to these plants. Following the release of this report, Home Depot announced it would require its suppliers to label all plants treated with neonicotinoid pesticides. You can see a little bit of the bill summary. This bill would modify when plants and other nursery stock may be labeled or advertised as pollinator friendly. It would apply this labeling to advertising restrictions to wholesalers and other non-retailers as well. One of the large changes is that it would lower the threshold to the detectable level of the pesticide, and that's a detail that we're trying to work out how that is defined. That's the summary of the bill, Madam Chair.
All right. I see that you have testifiers here. So before I call the first testifier, I just want to let all the testifiers know that today's we have a very full agenda. So if you can keep your testimony to under 2 minutes, that will be greatly appreciated. So our first testifier is Steve Ellis from Pollinator Stewardship Council over Zoom.
Yes. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. Please identify yourself before the committee. Proceed.
Yes, my name is Steve Ellis. I'm the current president of the Pollinator Stewardship Council. We're a national organization that works to defend pollinators from the adverse effects of pesticides. Erin Roop is also going to be testifying. She is a board member of our same organization. We have worked, both of us, on the Governor Dayton's Pollinator Protection Committee for a number of years and have worked on this issue extensively. I just would like to say in opening that these bills that are before you, these five bills that are being considered today, all will be substantial improvements in Minnesota's understanding and ability of local Minnesotans to be able to protect pollinators individually. Homeowners do not want to kill pollinators. They want to plant plants that are safe for pollinators. Farmers, likewise, do not want to kill pollinators. They know that they need and require us to do the services to provide good, vital crops for them to set seeds and have healthy production. Right now in California, the almond trees are blooming. It's the largest pollination event in the nation, and I'm proud to be a participant in it with my 1,300 hives that I transport from Minnesota to California. Bees and pollination are extremely important to the healthy ecosystems and agriculture. And taking these steps that the committee is reviewing today will be a big step in the right direction for people to be able to understand how they personally can have an impact. And I admire the committee for doing this work, looking at some very important bills. And I appreciate all the efforts that are being put forth here. If I have extra time, I'll turn it over to Aaron Roop at this point. I would like to thank the committee again for their due diligence here.
All right, thank you, Steve. Our next testifier is Aaron Roop. If you can identify yourself before the committee and proceed.
Hello, everyone. Can you? Yeah, you can hear me. I can hear myself. My name's Aaron Roop. I use she, her pronouns. I run Pollinate, Minnesota. Thank you to Chair Vang, to the members of the committee. I am voicing my strong support for all the bills being considered today. I think a lot about unknowns in my work. I run the organization Pollinate, Minnesota. I teach because learning about all these unknowns is pretty mind-blowing. So right now it's winter. Most of our native bees, well, I think everybody for the most part, are larvae in the soil, in stems. 30% of our native bees are in stems right now as like their caterpillar stage. And they are in diapause, and maybe somebody here knows more about what diapause means than I do. But just that example is so amazing to me, and the depths of the diversity of how we all live our lives is pretty amazing. And there's humility in this learning and listening, and the humility that is a natural repercussion of this learning. They're all such incredible metaphor and lessons to who we are as humans to each other, who you all are as humans in this decision-making capacity for the rest of us. There are folks here in opposition to these bills who will likely also mention unknowns. And there's a difference between the unknowns that we can attribute to our diverse biologies, our abilities as humans to see and listen and understand each other, and then the obfuscation of truth through process and systems. The EPA, in considering a new pesticide for registration, only requires pesticide testing on honeybees as a stand-in for all other terrestrial arthropods, and it only tests that honeybee colony for a few weeks or months. A honeybee colony feels the chronic impact of pesticide exposure for years if they live that long. And honeybees are not leafcutter bees or bumblebees or spiders or dragonflies or fireflies, right? There's incredible diversity here. The EPA process does not include the economics of harm that are a result of the product's use in their consideration of registration. The EPA does not consider the economic benefits of that product either. So if the EPA regulations the label as the law, which we might hear today, was protecting our ecosystems from harm, would we be experiencing the harms that you've read about in all of the written testimony, are hearing from my colleagues, are hearing from Vice Chair Purcell in the justification for this bill? This system chooses and has chosen the results we're experiencing over and over and over. And in the meantime, it demands that farmers be the experimenters to test out in their fields with their dollars next to their bodies if these chemistries will result in any economic benefit to them. And I think it's pretty useful to ask why. Here in Minnesota, we care about pollinators and insect decline, and our knowledge and understanding of the system is growing. And allowing the public to make the informed choice that this whole system has not made clear, and in the case of House File 1497, to purchase a bee-friendly plant that is not then going to cause harm to the bees that come to visit it because people want to be friendly to bees, it's a necessary small lift that you all can and should make today. So thank you for your support of House File 1497 and for your time.
All right, thank you. Are there any public testifiers that would like to testify for the bill? Seeing none, we'll move to discussion. Discussion to the bill. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, I think maybe a key part of this bill is the change from observed adverse effect to detectable level of systemic insecticide. It's a key piece. I think you said you're working out the details. Go into that a little bit deeper. Key part of the bill, we have to get that differentiation down solid.
Vice Chair Purcell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Lead Anderson. So, if you look at the fiscal note, part of the cost is just because there will be more laboratory costs. Before, we were just testing the flower. So this is detectable in potentially all the parts of the plant. And I just touched base very briefly with MDA to figure out what's possible. We know that we need to be more stringent and more precise instead of just, you know, checking on the flower real quick right away. We need to be we need to do our due diligence and looking at the plant as a whole and what it is holding. I am not a scientist or a lab technician to know exactly what detectable would be. So I think it is, I imagine where I will come out in the end with all these conversations is somewhere between the current language and, you know, any existence and detection at all, because we have to figure out what is practical, what actually can be done inside the lab and a level there. I'm sorry, I can't be more specific than that.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, today's equipment can measure parts per million, billion, trillion. And I'm just wondering how far this is going to go with a detectable that could be one part per trillion, for mm-hmm. example. Is that going to pull a product off the market? And then you mentioned it's going to be additional testing being done with the entire plant, not just the flower. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's a concern that the $40,000 annual cost will not be sufficient to cover the entire range of testing. So how are you going to handle that?
Vice Chair Purcell.
This is the number that came back from the agency when we asked them for the fiscal note. So I can't speak to how they landed upon that number, but I think you're right. I mean, we're going to be hopefully changing our processes. And so if it requires some additional funds, I'm not opposed to putting that in there. I think as one of the testifiers spoke to, I think that consumers deserve to know what they want to buy a plant that's pollinator friendly and not just pollinator attractive, but then actually kills the pollinator. So we do have to figure out what is the safe level for those insects.
Representative Anderson.
Well, thanks again, Madam Chair. Well, this kind of goes back to 2015, Representative Hansen and Representative McNamara at the time kind of worked out this compromise. And is it not working? Are there areas where some folks are selling shrubbery that's killing bees? Or why the movement from the compromise worked out 8 years ago?
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. I think there's a couple of things. One is that consumer confidence hasn't recovered, in my understanding from the 2014-2015 mass media event. And two, our pollinator populations haven't recovered either. And I think there are a lot of unknowns, and there could be all sorts of reasons, but this is an area where perhaps we could investigate and perhaps rule something out.
Representative Chow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for this bill. You know, you don't know how important bees are until none of your fruit trees bear fruits. You know, and I learned that, you know, and, you know, the declining of bee population colonies. I mean, we're looking at a precedent rate of 30% decline versus 10%. That's usually traditional, right? And a lot of us may know or may not know, but, you know, bees pollinate up to 2/3 of crops worldwide, right? And so thanks for bringing this legislation forward, because we need to do what we can do to curb that. Thank you.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And since my name was invoked and Representative Anderson, we've been here a while, so I'll try to go in the Wayback Machine here and to 2013 and 2014. The bill originally became law with the language that Representative Purcell is proposing. That was a detectable level. And then control of the legislature changed. And yes, I did work out language with Representative McNamara, because the provision was at risk of being gone altogether. And so I want to be clear that this is not, Representative Anderson said it would take something off the market. This is really a truth in labeling bill. You can't label something as pollinator friendly if it's not. And the validation or the verification of whether it was, if it's no observable level, that essentially says you've got to observe. You got to be at a concentration where it's observed that the pollinator would die, in effect. And we know what's changed over from 2014 and 2015 to now is, yes, our technology can go smaller, but we also know that the impacts on the pollinators, smaller amounts can have great impacts, lethal impacts. So that detectable level, and if you have a detectable level in something, if someone is buying a plant to help pollinators, the Department of Ag goes out, randomly tests the plant. If they detect a plant that is lethal to pollinators, a pesticide that's lethal to pollinators, you have multiple plants, the pollinator picks up the pesticide in multiple concentrations, and it has a cumulative effect that could kill the pollinator. So that detectable level is whether or not the plant has had the application. People buy flats from flats of plants, annuals, you know, and we get to Mother's Day, there's plants all over. But, and they're labeled for pollinator friendly. They may have a smiling bee on the flat. There may be advertising that has a happy monarch. But what this does is it provides truth in advertising. And yes, the technology's gotten better, but we also know the risk has gotten greater with smaller impacts of that. So I think it's a good bill. And it's good to review laws after 6, 8, 10, 12, 14 years sometimes.
Representative Jacob.
Thank you, Chair Vang. So could you explain to me, with respect to enforcement, if I purchase product outside of the state and bring it into the state, am I in violation, or how does that work?
Vice Chair Purcell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Jacob, my understanding is that this is only for items that are for sale in Minnesota.
So Representative Jacob.
That's kind of what I assumed. So I have a couple interstate bridges to Wisconsin in my district. Would this drive business outside of the state so they just don't have to deal with this regulation?
Vice Chair Purcell.
I don't imagine that happening, but I mean, you live on a border district, so people go there to buy fireworks, maybe. People might go there because bars are open later, so people are going to do what they're going to do, but I certainly think that the people of Minnesota want to know if they are buying a pollinator-friendly plant that it's not actually going to put our pollinators in harm's way.
Representative Jacob.
Thank you.
Representative Tappy.
Thank you, Chair Vang. I just want to reiterate with this bill that this is not telling anybody what they can and cannot sell. This is telling them how it's labeled. And they cannot use a pollinator-friendly label if they are using neonics in their growth process, whether that comes from Wisconsin or Oregon or wherever that comes from. It's just that they cannot use that in the labeling of the plants as they're selling them.
Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be quicker too. I just want to come back to what Representative Anderson was talking about. As far as the testing goes, and maybe Representative Purcell, if you could answer this, or I see Assistant Commissioner Faubel in the room, and I don't want to, you can maybe just nod, but is the equipment to do this testing at the lab now? Would you use third-party labs, or how would you see this? Is there equipment, do you need to purchase equipment?
Vice Chair Purcell?
I do not know the answer to that question.
Okay.
I don't know if there is someone
from the department.
Okay, come on down, phoning a friend.
If you can identify yourself before the committee and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Peter Chesson. I'm an assistant commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Representative, our lab currently does have equipment sufficient to, you know, determine if there's a detectable level. As Representative Purcell mentioned earlier, we are planning on meeting with her to discuss and try and define what that detectable level might be. So we support the overall goal of this bill, but as Representative Purcell, we're just going to have continued conversations about making it practical for our lab as well.
Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to that end, would the volume of testing increase to the level where you'd need to hire another lab tech, or how would you? I'm sure that's the conversation you're going to have, but I'm just curious about the cost, because it seems like $40,000 annually is just not going to cover that.
Commissioner Pater.
Madam Chair, Representative, yeah, that would be part of the conversation, just to make sure that we have the proper resources as well to effectuate the goal of the bill.
Representative Buerkle.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just walk us through a situation where a nursery, say, buys a stock from Iowa or wherever, and they're assured that it's pollinator-friendly according to that state's EPA designation. So in good faith, they put it out for sale, and it turns out they're spot-checked, whatever, and with our higher standards, they're against the law. They're going to be subject to fines. How is that going to work? And it's going to be, I've read the fines could be pretty substantial for a nursery that maybe unknowingly sells a product. So how do you handle that?
Vice Chair Purcell?
I can start. I don't know if you'll have something to add to this. It just lost me when I was going to respond, how I was going to respond to you. I think it has more to do with that labeling piece. So perhaps removing the tag that says pollinator friendly would be sufficient, because it is absolutely, because consumers are looking for that, that is sort of a value add. So if these plants were brought in and they didn't meet our standard, not that they couldn't be sold, they just would have to have that label removed, is my understanding.
Assistant Commissioner?
Yes, Madam Chair, members, we do have our Plant Protection Division Director, Mark Abrahamson, in the audience here today, and he can come up and talk more about specifics in regard to the current enforcement process.
Okay. Director Mark, if you can identify yourself before the committee and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mark Abrahamson, the Plant Protection Director, Department of Agriculture. Yes, so enforcement, as has been stated, the law says you can't advertise a plant as pollinator-friendly if it's containing pesticides. So enforcement is when we find that situation occurring, we issue a notice of violation that the nursery is in violation, and they need to remedy that situation. So typically what they do is they change the advertising, remove the tag, edit the tag in some way, but they would still be able to sell that plant just without the advertising. Our experience has been, I think this was mentioned, is that typically these locations are not aware that the plants have been treated with pesticides. So if they come from a third party, they're probably supplying nurseries in multiple states. If those other states don't have the same regulation, they're going to use the same tag. And so that's generally been our experience, is that they don't know that the plants have pesticides in them.
Okay. Final follow-up, Representative Anderson.
So would you advise anybody bringing in stock from out of state to take those labels off? If it says pollinator friendly in Iowa, for example, would you just recommend take them off?
Director Mark.
Without going through testing?
Director Mark. Yeah,
thanks, Madam Chair. Thank you for the question. So I think what we've seen over the 8 or 9 years that this has been in place is that we've seen a decrease in the number of times where we have had plants advertised as pollinator friendly and having pesticides. So I think that there is, some impact in the industry, and it may be that the people who are receiving the plants are communicating more with the suppliers to find that out if they're going to be advertised as pollinator-friendly, that they don't have pesticides in them. So I'm kind of speculating, but we have seen, a decrease over time in the situation occurring.
All right. Closing remarks. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks to my friends I got to phone and all the pollinators and the wonderful questions and thoughtful nature of the conversation. Something that Representative Cha brought up, my aunt and uncle lived in Japan for many years, and they talked about what a treat it was to get a watermelon. And that watermelon cost more than $100 US. This was back in the 90s. And that was because they did not have pollinators, and that watermelon was hand-pollinated with a little paintbrush. I certainly hope we never get to that point. And I thank you for your support and consideration of this bill.
All right. And with that, Vice Chair Purcell renews her motion that House File 1497 be laid over for possible inclusion. House File 1497 is laid over for possible inclusion. Our next bill is House File 1130, Representative Tapke. With that, I move that House File 1130 be laid over for possible inclusion. I see that we have the A1 amendment, the author's amendment. So, Representative Tapke, whenever you're ready, please move your amendment
Thank you, Madam Chair. And yeah, I have the A1 and the A3 amendment are both mine. So I move the A1 amendment as an author's amendment.
All right. To your A1.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we, with this bill, House File 1130, do you want me to talk about the bill now or do we want to get it?
To the A1 amendment.
The A1, just we've been working with a variety of different stakeholders on this bill to help make sure it works as well as possible for everyone. And this one is from different folks in the ag community to make sure that we have very clear language in here that if there is, as we, it makes sure that we are able to exempt ag land within cities.
All right. Discussion to the A1 amendment. Hearing none. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. The ayes have it and the motion prevails. The A1 is adopted. The next amendment is the A3. To the A3, Representative Chapke.
This one just makes very clear as to what pesticides can and cannot be used in wood preservative products, Madam Chair.
All right. Discussion. Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed say nay. The ayes haven't, and the motion prevails. The A3 amendment is adopted. Now it is in the shape that you want. To the bill, Representative Tapke.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. So this bill is House File 1130. This is a local control bill that allows communities to work with and do what is best for them and their communities if they have folks that are concerned about use of pesticides from a variety of angles, that they are able to exempt to make sure that those pesticides are not to be able to use in that in their community. There's a significant number of folks across the world who and across the United States who have different levels of exemption of not exemption. I keep using that word, and I should not. I apologize, but of preemption of utilizing some different types of pesticides in their communities. And so we have a list of things that cannot be preempted in this bill. So it focuses on pollinator lethal pesticides. So as we've been talking about today, this is the purpose of this is to make sure that we aren't killing off all of our friends. And so this does not apply to pet care products, personal care products, indoor pest products, pesticides used by mosquito control district, wood products, and then as the amendments put forward, we exempted ag land as well in case there's something around Palmer amaranth infestation or something like that that happens on ag land, that we are able to control those issues without concern about preemption to make sure that the state is taken care of. So thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. We'll move to testimony first and then we'll have discussion. Please keep it under 2 minutes. The first one is Indira Falana from the city of Minneapolis. If you can please identify yourself before the committee and proceed.
Hello, good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Indira Falana, and I'm a government relations representative with the city of Minneapolis, and I'm here to speak in support of House File 1130. We know that pollinators are a necessary component of a healthy ecosystem and food system, providing essential pollination of plants in order to grow vegetables, herbs, and fruits. Local food production is needed to improve the health and food security of Minneapolis residents, and insect pollination is an essential component of local food production. So we are proud to be one of 44 municipalities in the state that is pledged to be pollinator friendly. And in 2015, our city council unanimously passed and adopted a resolution declaring Minneapolis a pollinator friendly community. And with this resolution, we celebrated current policies and practices that protect and support pollinator health, including reducing the city's pesticide use, while we also encouraged our residents and businesses to adopt pollinator-friendly practices, such as committing to not using pesticides, including systemic insecticides on their property, and also avoiding planting flowering plants that are treated with systemic insecticides. House File 1130 would complement the resolution and pledge that the city of Minneapolis has made to ensure that we protect pollinator populations by allowing all Minnesota cities to prohibit the use of pollinator lethal insecticides within their borders. We appreciate the committee for taking up this legislation and thank Rep. Tabke for carrying this bill. Thank you.
All right, next testifier is Aaron Rupp from Pollinate Minnesota. If you can please identify yourself before the committee again, proceed.
Hello, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This is the last time you'll hear from me today. I'm Erin Roop. I run Pollinate Minnesota
I use she, her pronouns. I'm a board member of Pollinator Stewardship Council, a mom of two kids who are 5 and 2. I strongly support all these bills. Thank you so much for your bravery in hearing them. I'm a beekeeper. I hang out with one species of insect a whole lot. And we know as of last month, thanks to the DNR, to you all for funding this research, that we have over 500 species of bee in Minnesota. Because researchers thought to look in marsh ecosystems in the spring and found 40 new species who had been here the whole time. But, you know, now we know about them. And this is an estate that has, over the last decade, contributed significant state funding to pollinator research and habitat. It's an estate where we have one of the top bee research labs in the world. So this very tangible and visible pace of discovery has my heart. Insects are so diverse, and just because our discovery is new does not mean their existence or critical niche in ecosystems is. We are killing them with our pesticide use, both acutely in one exposure, chronically over time. It's not a mystery. Legal use of pesticides as currently regulated by law, with the label as the law, as I'm guessing we may hear some today, by the EPA and the MDA is directly causing death and decline to our pollinators and ecosystems. And Representative Cha, thank you for bringing in that 30% loss number. Average loss of honeybees for hobby beekeepers in Minnesota last year was 76%. And if we weigh that for towards commercial beekeepers, it's a little better at 58%. But that's if you do everything right with generations of experience, half of your livestock die annually. We talk about honeybees because we measure them and see them, and it's inherently easy to gather data on them. But this system is continually choosing this poisoning, continually justifying it, as you may hear today. And municipalities around the state have passed resolutions to be pollinator-friendly and are doing what they can to protect pollinators and ecosystems. And this bill would untie their hands to give them the action step to mitigate these exposures if they choose it. So thank you for your support of House File 1130 and for your time.
All right. Next one is Rob Greer from Minnesota Pest Management Association. If you can please identify yourself before the committee and proceed.
I'm Rob Greer, Associate Certified Entomologist and representing Minnesota Pest Management Association, which is the primary trade group representing the structural pest management industry in Minnesota. Our companies manage pests including rodents, ants, cockroaches, bedbugs, mosquitoes, spiders, stinging insects, termites, and other pests in countless commercial, residential, and institutional settings. And approximately 97% of pest control companies in Minnesota are small businesses, which feel the impacts of these things pretty heavily. The goal of this legislation is to protect pollinators. Other things to consider are it will give 853 cities the right to ban neonics and other pesticides at will, not based off of science, but based on sentiment. In the previous bill, we covered some of the difficulties in testing, and the Department of Ag is set up for that. Individual cities are not. Since honeybee colony collapse disorder was identified in the late 2000s, it is well-researched and understood that the main culprit is the varroa mite, not pesticides. A lot more can be found out from the University of Minnesota Bee Lab on this. In fact, there were 125,000 honeybee colonies in 2021 in Minnesota, and that's more than 5,000 more than the 120,000 that existed in 2003 before colony collapse disorder. If we really want to do something to protect the pollinators, we don't want to take away the tools that are being used to protect people, structures, and the environment. Instead, let's promote planting pollinator-friendly plants, educate consumers of the dangers of do-it-yourself pesticides, or take them away from those people that don't have the training. We don't want to impact the trained, tested, certified, insured, and licensed applicators. We know what to apply, where to apply, when not to apply, etc. This legislation will do nothing to stop uneducated consumers from buying products off the internet or at home improvement stores and applying it themselves. Some of the unintended consequences from this, with those 853 cities, they will not be able to ban, 853 cities will not only be able to ban pesticides they want, but they will also become the licensing arm, the enforcement arm, and the testing arm. None of them are equipped or trained to do so. and shifting that because of the 12% of the state's population that it represents, that would represent a 12% budget cut for the Department of Ag. Can you imagine the nightmare of especially these small businesses, 200 companies having to figure out 853 different sets of legislation? A lot of the technicians, especially in some of the outskirt markets, are having to cover 60 miles in a day, which can take into account several different things in one day, so that really complicates the issue for them. Some of the products we use could be at risk, including those for termites and flies. Termite treatments are required for FHA loans in most of Minnesota, and innocuous things like outdoor uses of fly bait to trash cans and dumpsters could be banned by cities if they opted in. Termites do more damage in this country than floods and fires combined, and they are a growing issue in Minnesota. Additionally, flies are known to be disease carriers, and losing access to fly baits would allow their populations to flourish.
Mr. Gere, if you can please wrap up your testimony.
Sounds good.
All right, next is Corey Bennett from Minnesota Soybean Growers Association. All right. Next, we have Nathan Newlands from Spring Touch Lawns over Zoom. If you can please identify yourself before the committee, proceed.
Yeah, my name is Nathan Newlands, Madam Chair and committee members. Thank you for your time today. My name is Nathan Newlands. I'm the Vice President of Operations for Spring Touch Lawn and Pest Control, which my father-in-law founded 50 years ago. We're a family-owned and operated business that employs around 80 employees in southern Minnesota, and we are one of those people that cover a large range of up to 60-mile radius from where we are. We are opposed to the HF 1130, which seeks to shift regulatory power from the state to cities that greatly lack the resources, experience, and expertise to effectively regulate pesticide use. A shift to local regulation would create a disastrous patchwork of inconsistent standards that would make it nearly impossible for any business or applicator to do their job safely and efficiently. As a company, we work together with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture and our local inspector to ensure that we are abiding by all rules and regulations with the use of the pesticides. Every one of our applicators is licensed by the Department of Agriculture to apply the right pesticides. The Minnesota Department of Agriculture also works with the University of Minnesota to provide continued education, which is required by a licensed applicator to be completed every year or other year, depending on the licenses. As a lawn and pest control company, we help safeguard against invasive species that transmit dangerous and deadly diseases that threaten Minnesotans. Invasive species in one area will inevitably breed, grow, and relocate to other areas. Restricting pesticide use in one city unnecessarily jeopardizes the public health, not only in the one area, but in surrounding areas as well. Mosquitoes carry the West Nile virus, where a tick with Lyme disease won't be contained by political borders that separate the cities. As a business, we're extremely aware of the health and safety of the pollinators and their habitats, and it's our top priority to our applicators. If you were to visit our location here in St. Peter in summer, you would see wildflower beds and then also a lot of different trees and stuff to attract those pollinators. And whenever we encounter any customers with bee issues, we do reach out to our local beekeepers to able to come in and take that control of that situation. Minnesota Department of Agriculture and the EPA bring financial and human resources to bear on this important issue that are far greater than any individual city possibly could. I cannot, in my wild, bright mind, see any city having the wide range of knowledge and resources available to make the best scientific decisions that are needed. That is why these decisions should be left to the Minnesota Department of Agriculture and the EPA. We need decisions made on a state level that are clear, consistent with federal law, and based on scientific facts. Thank you for your time.
All right, thank you. Our final testifier is Terine Stovall. If you can please identify yourself before the committee and proceed.
Absolutely. Thank you for your time. My name is Terrence Stovall. I'm the state and local government manager for the National Association of Landscape Professionals, which is a national trade organization that represents the $98 billion landscape industry that employs over 1.4 million employees in the United States. Since 1987, the Minnesota Department of Agriculture has had the sole substantive regulatory authority over pesticides, including sale, distribution, application, use, and education. Minnesota is one of 44 states that has this statutory preemption over local regulation of pesticides. And all pesticide applicators in the state are certified and licensed by the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. So there's significant state and federal oversight to ensure industry compliance and the proper use of pesticide products. Any shift to local regulation would create a complicated and confusing patchwork of inconsistent standards that would make it nearly impossible for applicators to effectively protect and maintain work and recreational spaces within the state that all Minnesotans enjoy. NALP shares a desire to protect Minnesota's residents and ecosystems from pest and invasive species alike. But the reality is that local jurisdictions just lack the resources and expertise to effectively regulate pesticides. EPA employs more than 900 experts to review information on pesticide safety and efficacy before making a decision to register that product for sale and use. And after EPA completes their extensive review, the Minnesota Department of Agriculture also reviews each pesticide registration in relation to Minnesota. Municipalities cannot replicate this high standard of expertise, effective regulation, vast resources, and the safety protocols of both these entities. The professional landscape industry implores the committee to consider the ramifications the local pesticide regulation would have on applicators who operate across city and county lines, and in turn, the effects of the inconsistent restrictions will have on mitigation efforts across the state. The MDA and APA have established processes and a regulatory framework that maintains the safe use of pesticides based on scientific evaluations and reviews, and regulatory power should remain vested in them. It's for these reasons that the National Association of Landscape Professionals implores the members of this committee to maintain statewide uniformity and vote against this measure. Thank you for your time, and I yield back.
All right, and our next testifier is Russ Henry. If you can please identify yourself before the committee and proceed.
Hello, my name is Russ Henry, and I'm a Minneapolis resident. I'm the owner of Minnehaha Falls Landscape and the founder of Be Safe Minneapolis. I'd just like to say, Madam Chair and to the committee, this bill before you is extraordinarily important. As a landscaper, I visit over 300 residential, municipal, and business properties per year. I consult with folks on these properties. And what I've been seeing in the field since I've been doing this for the last 20 years is staggering. When I'm visiting on home landscapes, I started keeping track of how often I'm seeing wind-pollinated trees being injected with insecticides. And it's around 67% of residences that I visit annually are injecting insecticides into native trees. Native trees are supposed to be buffets for wild insects, for the wildlife, and injecting them, allowing the injection of insecticides, neonicotinoids, and others into these trees is absolutely irresponsible. We need to give the cities the power to legislate, to protect their citizens. If you think about it, all of that neonicotinoid is systemic. It goes into every part of the tree. Now, these are wind-pollinated trees. So I want us all to walk outside this spring and take a big, deep breath of that air that is filled with pollen that is filled with neonicotinoid. We need to do something about this. And as an owner in this industry, I find it reprehensible that other representatives of this industry are coming in here and demanding that we keep things as they are. As they are is extinction. I am the father, most importantly in my life, of three boys, 2 8-month-old baby twins, Patrick and William, and I'm here for them. I want us to have a future with insects and frogs and birds. I want them to be able to know what wildlife is. Thank you.
All right, and with that, we will move to discussion of the bill. Representative Cha.
Thank you, Chair. I thought you recognized my colleague over there first, but well, that was really powerful. Thanks for the testimony. I want to also share that something similar in Woodbury. When I moved to Woodbury in 1996, we used to go fishing in those lakes, in those ponds. And they're like big bass and everything, and you'll see families with their kids fishing in Woodbury. That's 96. After 2003, no one's fishing on the banks. Nobody's even canoeing. It's heartbreaking as a father of three children, you know. And so what I want to ask you, Representative Tapke, is that you've been chair in Shakopee Chamber of Commerce. You've been on the chair of Parks and Rec. You've been the mayor of Shakopee. So give us into perspective, because I think your experience at the local level is important here and why this bill is talking about local control. So can you talk about that? Thanks.
Yeah.
Representative Tapke.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Shaw. So those things are absolutely important because I feel that local communities, as often as we possibly can, should have as many of the decisions as possible. And this is one of those places where it makes complete sense for the local community to be able to make those decisions. But in addition to those things, I've also been chair of committee with the Minnesota Nursery Landscape Association. I have the National Landscape Association that testified. I've also been on committees with the National Landscape Association. And we see a lot of things. So if I were the Minnesota Nursery and Landscape Association, I would be extremely upset with the national organization because MNLA they're not happy with this bill, but they don't oppose this bill. There are things that they'd like to see done differently in the future, and we can continue to work on things. But there is a major problem that we have with how pesticides are used throughout the state of Minnesota and by landscape and by pesticide companies and different things like that. And through my work, I see it every day when you're out in the summertime and it's 90 degrees and the wind's blowing 30 miles an hour and there'll be companies out spraying turf and that kind of thing should not happen. That is extremely dangerous to everyone in the area, to the pesticide applicator, and I'm the guy that reports all those things. And so I reported to the Department of Ag and we roll with it from there. But I think it is important that we allow local communities to make those decisions as to what works best for their community. So thank you for the question.
Representative Harder.
Thank you, Chair Vang. Representative Tapke, I have a couple of questions. So according to the fiscal note, thank you for that. It says that this is going to allow cities to develop their ordinances, do their own licensing, penalties, and enforcement provisions. So basically, the city is going to take the responsibility versus MDA. My question might be more directed to the young lady from the city of Minneapolis. So has your city determined, like, how many FTE it will take to do this for their city?
Is Representative Tapke.
So this bill is not... This bill doesn't change anything other than giving the opportunity to... to not use pesticides in a community. That's the only thing that changes. And so if a community were to go down that road in deciding that if, we'll say the city of Shakopee chooses that they don't want to use certain type of, broadleaf weed control or something like that, which like many municipalities and countries throughout the world and throughout North America have done that kind of thing, and there haven't been significant detrimental effects whatsoever. And so there are other ways to handle these kinds of things. And so if that were to happen that a community wanted to not use X or Y pesticide, then they would start down that road of working with the Department of Agriculture and understanding what it really means to do that. So depending on the municipality and the city, they would work with the Department of Ag to get that figured out, because right now the Department of Ag has roles and responsibilities. If a community wanted to take on those roles and responsibilities, they can, and they will go through that process on their own. The state doesn't just say, hey, you can do this. You've got to go through and work with the Department of Ag and get that done to make sure all the roles and responsibilities are taken. So it would differ by community for sure.
Representative Harder.
Thank you, Chair Vang. So taking, for instance, Representative Tapke, Shakopee. So I'm guessing that a number of businesses from outside of Shakopee come to your city to do whatever that they do for landscaping. How will the city go about informing all of these people that come to your city to follow the ordinance?
Representative Tapke.
Madam Chair and Representative Harder. So the way this would happen is if you look on that MDA would keep a list. I don't know exactly where that is on here, but it would. So there would be the cities would make sure that that is advertised. And like right now, as was discussed many times by testifiers, there are 853 different cities. If we see more than a few different cities, I don't imagine there are many different communities that would take advantage of this legislation at this time. But if we see many communities that start to go down this path, that indicates to the state that we should be making some changes. And there are some things from local communities that we can and should learn from as a state. And so having been in the shoes of someone who has applied pesticides and in cities throughout the metro, I mean, this is done all the time. Cities have different regulations for different things constantly. There are different regulations for irrigation. There are different regulations for water use. There are different regulations for a lot of things. It's just pesticides are something that they aren't able to make their own best choices for their community.
Representative Harder.
Thank you, Chair Vang. Thank you for that. So if the ordinances are passed, and let's say that the cities are not following, what will MDA do to a jurisdiction that fails to enforce? Is the department gonna fine or penalize the city? Will the department say, sorry, city, you're not following the rules? Whatever it is, what will the department do when a city fails to enforce their own rules?
Representative Tapke.
Madam Chair and Representative Hart, I don't really understand your question. If a city fails to do what?
Representative Harder.
So if the department determines that a city is not following their own ordinance, I'm guessing that department will be spot checking cities to see that they're following the ordinance. What does the department do?
Representative
What would the department do?
Representative Tapke.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Harder. So if, let's say, the city of Shakopee chooses to discontinue the use of some pesticide, the Department of Ag is not going to check on them to see if they're actually discontinuing the use of that pesticide or not. That's a city problem from there. That's not what the Department of Ag would do. The Department of Ag checks licensure and makes sure that things are being applied appropriately and that kind of stuff. But that's not something that would happen with this ordinance or just even in general.
Final follow-up, Representative Harder.
Okay, let me ask another way. So the city creates the ordinance that follows, however that it is. Okay, so let's say that the city is not following its ordinance. What does the Department of Agriculture do? Would they take the jurisdiction back and say, sorry, city, you're not following, so therefore we're taking our authority back on for you?
Representative Tapke.
Madam Chair and Representative Hart, the Department of Ag doesn't care. Like, as long as when pesticides are being applied and being utilized, if they are fall within the Department of Ag's umbrella of how that is all happening, they want it to be applied per labeling. They want it to be applied appropriately and with licensure and correct licensure and that kind of thing. But if we'll keep using Shakopee, if Shakopee stops the use of some sort of pesticide, then the Department of Ag doesn't, if this passes, then the Department of Ag doesn't necessarily care if they use it or don't use it. I'm not sure, as long as it's being used when it's used per Department of Ag specifications, then they don't have a dog in the fight on this one.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Tabke, your bill does change things. If cities adopt this ordinance, I would assume they also adopt enforcement. And the gentleman from Minneapolis who testified that a lot of trees were being injected, that's not a good thing. I agree with that. But I don't assume the state is allowing that. I would assume a lot of it is being done on the side. And no matter who has the authority, the state or the city of Minneapolis, unless you have enforcement, that's going to continue going on. We're not going to probably stop that situation with this bill. You know, this bill's been around for many years. First, it was cities of the first class. And I'd like to know, I don't have to call her up, but the lady from Minneapolis, how many more people you would have to hire to implement and enforce this registration regulation if the city took it on its own. And the last thing I'll say is, it always strikes me as ironic that I would assume the largest user of pesticides by far in the metro is the Mosquito Control District, and they're exempt from this. They always have been. They are in this legislation as well. So it just seems to me that we're kind of nipping around the edges, trying to, you know, be pollinator friendly and such, which is a good thing. But I don't think this bill really accomplishes that.
And Dara, would you like to respond to the question? Representative Tapke?
Madam Chair and Representative Lee Anderson, the only thing I really want to address on that is the Mosquito Control District portion of this. They do just fascinating work on where they use and don't use. So I would absolutely encourage everyone. There's a lot of information out there, and the Mosquito Control does have great videos. Three Rivers Park District has great videos and information about how they utilize pesticides in very strategic, organized ways in order to meet their goals and work with issues, as was brought up earlier, around malaria and deadly diseases that could be transferred. So it's really interesting if you're a nerd. So,
all right. Perhaps, Indira, if you can follow up with the committee afterwards on responding to Representative Anderson's question of how many FT it will take to follow through with this bill. Next is Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Anderson beat me to the question, and so I won't ask it again, other than to say that maybe frame it up in the context of the rural and urban. I mean, are you saying, would this bill imply then that the city of Moorhead or a small town like Badger can't spray for mosquitoes? They could set up a city ordinance that says they couldn't. I'm just confused on why that would, well, how would that work?
Representative Tapke.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Burkle. Again, I'm not sure I understand your question. This is Metropolitan Mosquito Control District is a specified entity.
Right.
So that would not apply to Moorhead or Baxter, no.
So they okay.
Representative Burkle.
So then the question, I mean, the argument I'm making here, I guess, is, I think, I mean, you mentioned the fascinating work they do, and I would make the case that, you know, I think there's all kinds of situations where farmers or landscapers or nursery owners, they do fascinating work too. And I think responsibly use pesticides. And I just think it's interesting that, you know, I'd be curious to know, and I don't want to outright call this bill, you know, virtue signaling, but in a sense it kind of is, if we're not going to be honest about it. So I'm just curious how folks in that district, in that Metropolitan Mosquito Control District you're talking about, would be willing to give up the creature comforts of having mosquitoes sprayed for versus, you know, saving pollinators. Just a thought. Thank you.
Representative Jacob.
Thank you, Chair Vang. So just in the interest of understanding real-world application, my county, Winona County, Emerald Ash Borer has run its course in my county. The only remaining trees are the trees that have been heavily injected with insecticide. So how would this bill affect remaining cities who are dealing with things of that nature? I mean, if they take advantage of this ordinance, can they treat their trees, or would they have to let them all die?
Representative Tapke.
Madam Chair and Representative Jacob, I'm not sure what's not clear about this, but this bill doesn't do anything to force the city to do something, to not do something. It just allows them. So if you have a community who is all communities and throughout Minnesota will deal with emerald ash borer at some point. And this is not saying that people have to or don't or can't do anything unless the community says so. So if your community has different needs and different specific needs, then your community can do it. So I'm not sure exactly what this, if you're trying to conflate things or change the subject, I'm not quite sure what the point of the question is around this doesn't force anybody to do anything with emerald ash borer. Like, this is allowing a community to do something if they want to, if they can help their community to save different insects because we have collapsing ecosystems and where things are going. But it doesn't force anybody to do anything.
Representative Jacob.
Well, I think the idea of using a real-world application of something that we're dealing with presently, what I'm saying is we don't know what will happen in the future, but if the city thought that they were doing a great thing by adopting this ordinance and a new tree disease comes along and they've got this ordinance in place, would they then they just wouldn't be able to save those, in this case, save those particular trees? Or if they've adopted this, or retroactively, in my case, if a, I'm just going to single out perhaps a environmental group thinks that this would be a good idea, and the only trees remaining in the city of Winona, the only ash trees remaining are those that have been heavily injected with pesticides. If some people determine that we have to have this ordinance, then the rest of the people are going to have to let their trees die, right?
Representative Tapke.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Jacob. That is up to your city council. You've served on local government, I believe. I have as well. And local government is nimble and able to make decisions and to change things. As so if a new emerald ash borer comes along, which there are thousands of them that they could be, they can make decisions that are the right thing for their community. Or they can say that we're going to adopt Minnesota Department of Ag rules and regulations on XYZ topic, whatever that may be. It is, I know quite a few folks in Winona, and they're pretty smart, and I'm positive that they're awesome enough to figure it out.
All right, closing remarks, Representative Tapke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a bill that will allow local control to continue letting communities support their needs and support their community in the best way that they know. And also, I need to make a note that instead of this being laid over for possible inclusion, we are going to have this bill re-referred to the Environment Committee, Madam Chair, if that's all right. So that's what the motion will be for moving that in.
All right. Representative Tapke renews their motion that House File 1130 as amended be re-referred to the Environment Committee. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay.
No.
The ayes have it. And House File 1130, as amended, is we refer to the Environment Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
The next bill that we have is
Madam Chair. Madam Chair.
Representative Anderson.
That's a bit surprising. Is that what the opening request was, to refer this bill on to the next committee when the representative opened his presentation?
Representative Anderson, you are correct. It was my mistake to lay the bill over, and Representative Tapke has renewed his motion to re-refer it, and so we have voted on the motion, and we'll move forward to the next bill.
I'm not so sure that's the way it should go, being we're all under the impression it was going to be held over, and you, in fact, said it was going to be held over. I just don't think that's right, but it's your prerogative.
All right. Thank you, Representative Anderson. I will make note of that and make sure that the motion is clear from the very beginning. And with that, House File 1150, Representative Hansen, please move your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would move that House File 1150 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
All right. Discussion to your bill. To your bill, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, this Bill 1150 relates to the intersection of PFAS. We have a number of bills going with perfluoroalkyl and polyfluoroalkyl substances moving throughout the legislature. In recent weeks, there have been publications indicating that there are PFAS products, whether they're an inert ingredient or an intentionally added substance, in pesticides. I think this is a really stunning question, because if they are in pesticides and they are being purchased and being spread as a pesticide or with the pesticide, that is very concerning. It's a very simple bill. What I'm doing here is giving the authority, and this is why this was being laid over, Representative Anderson, given the authority of the Commissioner of Agriculture, Tom Peterson, currently, must not register under his authority for registering products, a pesticide product that contains PFAS. I've met with the department. There's likely, that was kind of a stunning conversation as well, because for testing for the PFAS, the cross-contamination potential for PFAS in testing equipment may be there. They may have to have a separate location for actually testing for PFAS. I think folks should just ponder that for a moment. That if we have PFAS and things that contaminate because they're forever chemicals, we may have to have a separate testing location for them, for products that are sold into commerce. And I think the department is here who can testify as to that. I think it's important to look at this. If we are using unknowingly PFAS with pesticides, and that's the bill I'd ask for your. I'm open for any questions. I think there are a number of testifiers, and the department is also available.
All right. I just have two testifiers noted here. So the first one is Willa Childress from Pesticide Action Network. You can identify yourself before the committee and keep it under 2 minutes.
Greetings, Madam Chair and members of this committee. Thank you for taking up this urgent issue of PFAS contamination in pesticides. My name is Willa Childress, and I'm here on behalf of Pesticide Action Network's 1,000 members in Minnesota. We work alongside rural community members, family farmers, beekeepers, and others concerned about the impacts of pesticides on their health and livelihood. As you will hear from the lead researcher, Mr. Lassay's testimony, in 2017, a study at Texas Tech tested common pesticides for PFAS contamination. They were shocked to find very high levels of contamination in common pesticides, and even that the crops grown in these fields tested at 100 times EPA's lifetime drinking water limit. This research was just published last year, and it is horrifying. Because inert ingredients do not need to be listed, the public had no idea until this study was published last year that pesticides had been indeed contaminated with PFAS. Scientists agree that PFAS are not a necessary adjuvant for pesticides. When used as an inert ingredient, they don't meaningfully increase the efficacy of the pesticide product, and they can be replaced with non-PFAS alternatives. I don't think anyone knew that they were even being used up until this point. Considering that PFAS are forever chemicals, they don't belong in pesticides that are being used broadly on the landscape where we grow our food. PFAS exposure is linked to various health outcomes, including multiple cancers, developmental damage and birth defects, and impaired functioning of the liver, kidneys, and immune system. This is not to mention that there are many toxic pesticides still on the market with health risks of their own. There's currently zero research on the synergistic effects of combining PFAS and pesticide chemicals. Luckily in Minnesota, we have the opportunity to stop this dangerous practice in its tracks and ensure that pesticides registered in the state are not contaminated with added forever chemicals. We know from stories coming from across the country that farmers on PFAS contaminated land have had to take their farmland out of production, lost their business, and been forced to leave their homes.
Ms. Wallace, if you can please finish your thought.
Yes, we can't run the risk of doing this to our rural neighbors, and I urge committee members to support this bill and its passage. Thank you.
All right, the next testifier is Stephen Lassie from over Zoom. If you can please identify yourself before the committee, proceed.
Hi, I'm Dr. Stephen Lassie. I'm an environmental toxicologist and chemist, and I've been researching PFAS exposure for nearly 10 years, particularly around the consumption of food and drink. I'm also a resident of Minnesota, and I currently live in Duluth. I recently published a peer-reviewed study where I found PFAS concentrations in 6 out of 10 tested pesticides. These pesticides are widely used in the United States. The PFAS I observed was not a listed component of the products. How'd they get there? The manufacturing process, inert proper proprietary ingredients, contamination. Regardless of how the PFAS got into the pesticides, it will end up on anything they're applied to, including our food. EPA scientists have estimated that as much as 98% of the average American's exposure to PFAS happens through their mouths. Many PFAS have incredibly long biological half-lives, as high as 10 plus years in humans, making any exposure to these chemicals a lifelong ordeal. My discovery was made at a USDA crop genetics research center, so I tested the crops grown at the site to see if the PFAS concentrations I found in the pesticides were reflected in the crops. Corn, green beans, peanuts had PFAS concentrations of 320 parts per trillion, 430, and 440 parts per trillion. I tried sampling nearby fields to find PFAS-free controls, and I couldn't find any. This suggests that PFAS contamination I observed could be pervasive and impact several different crops. A single serving of the highest concentration vegetable I tested will result in a PFAS exposure equivalent to consuming 1,400 years of water at the EPA's interim health advisory level of 0.02 parts per trillion. I know this sounds ridiculous, 1,400 years of exposure from a single cup of beans, but the interim health advisory level set up by the EPA was done under the idea that no exposure to PFAS and PFOA is really safe over a lifetime. I also tested the soil at the site and had concerning concentrations of PFAS as well. This will be available for plant uptake for years to come. Thank you. And
all right. Discussion to the bill. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hansen, any idea how many chemicals this would impact? And then the other two part of the question is, you know, there's active ingredients and inert ingredients, and some inert ingredients are not listed and they're proprietary. How would we be able to distinguish if there's PFAS in those ingredients?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would ask the Department of Ag to come up in case I am incorrect on my numbers. But I believe that their impression was it was 10 products now that EPA had said that they know that are in the active ingredient. As you mentioned, inert ingredients are proprietary. I think that's the question of testing. Do we need to be testing this? And most of those 10 are products that are no longer, the older chemistry is the most studied chemistry. The newer chemistry is the least studied chemistry. So on the question of how many beyond that 10 that we may not know of, we don't have an answer. But if I'm incorrect on that, the testifiers can.
Assistant Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, again, my name is Peter Chesed, Assistant Commissioner of Minnesota Department of Agriculture. And before I turn it over to my colleague here who knows the science much better than I do, I just want to thank Representative Hansen for bringing this bill. The department is very interested in playing a role in approaching PFAS in pesticides. We're well positioned to play that role with our current pesticides regulatory program. And we have a whole host of highly qualified scientists that know about the importance of certain pesticides for Minnesota, as well as the viability of alternatives. And at this point, Madam Chair, if I could pass it over to my colleague, that'd be great. Thank you.
If you can please identify yourself. And
yeah, Madam Chair and members, my name is Dan Stoddard. I'm Assistant Director in the Pesticide and Fertilizer Management Division. And Representative Anderson, to answer your question, we really need to consider the definition of PFAS. So EPA was using a working definition which was less rigorous than the definition that's currently being used in the state. And using the previous definition, Representative Hansen was right. They were aware of 10 pesticides that had PFAS. Those would be active ingredients, not inerts. But using the definition that's associated with the bills that are moving forward, which is one fully fluorinated hydrocarbon, we know of about 85 active ingredients in Minnesota that have PFAS using that definition. And using that, there's about 970 active ingredients that are registered for use in Minnesota. There's about 14,000 pesticide products. So about 85 active ingredients using that definition would contain PFAS. That's about 2,000. Of the 14,000 active ingredients. So 14 to 15% of the active ingredients, of the pesticides currently registered would meet that current definition. And that does not include non-agricultural pesticides. It also does not include inerts. So it's likely that the number of pesticides that contain PFAS is probably well above 2,000.
Representative Anderson.
Very quickly, thank you, Madam Chair. So that's a pretty staggering number of ag chemicals. Are there replacements for them, or what? I mean, to take that number off the market in some kind of fashion is going to be pretty significant. What's going to replace them?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, I think there would have to be a careful review of the products that are out there, the chemistries that they have, and they'd have to come up with alternatives. And I think at this point it's really unclear whether or not there could be alternatives for every product. Some products, it might be a difficulty coming up with alternatives, and some there likely could be alternative products.
Representative Cha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Give you some name of some of these East Metro cities: Afton, Cottage Grove, Denmark Township, Great Cloud Island, Hastings, Lake Elmo, Lake St. Croix Beach, Lakeland, Lake Shores, Maplewood, Newport, Oakland, St. Mary's, St. Paul Park, Stillwater, Westlake Township, Woodbury. Why am I naming these cities? Because of the 3,860 private wells that are tested, 1,481 of those wells have PFAS in it. That's 38%. This is East Metro, where I'm from, Woodbury. We have 19 wells for the city of Woodbury. Six of them are closed, shut down. We're going to close another one. The seventh well that we close in Woodbury is going to affect the water production for Woodbury residents. And so every time I hear about this topic of forever chemicals, we need to do more, and more legislation that we put on the table, the better Minnesotan and East Metro families are going to have a better future. So I thank you for bringing this legislation forward, and I hope we can continue this work and make things happen. Thank you.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Chair Vang, and I don't know whether it's to Chair Hansen or Department of Agriculture. Do you have some trade names, or can we have some ideas of what some of these products are, or is that, if there's 2,000 out of, I think 14,000, if I heard this correctly, should be some fairly known trade names, or...
Mr. Sutter?
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't have handy some of the products that would be included in that 85 active ingredients, but we could make those available.
Representative Nelson. Representative House Hansen.
I'll wrap my closing into it. Representative Nelson, there may be active ingredients that have gone off patent, so there may be multiple trade names that are there. So I think if we can get the active ingredients, that helps out in knowing what the trade names are. Because there's a variety of them depending on the age. And again, the older they are, the more chemistry, the more knowledge we have because they've been tested longer. I think this is an important bill. I've been working with the department. I think they indicated on the record here that they are very interested in this bill, want to work on it. It's being laid over. Happy to work with folks on this. It's probably going to take some money to make sure we can do that assessment. But
as Representative Cha said, I mean, we're finding PFAS everywhere now, and if it's in the pesticides, we need to know about it and do something about it.
All right. Representative Hansen renews their motion that House File 1150 be laid over for possible inclusion. House File 1150 is laid over for possible inclusion. Members, we might not have time for the final bill, House File 2472. I know that I recognize that this is an important day for a lot of stakeholders on this discussion regarding pesticides and pollinators. So we'll reserve the final bill for the next available hearing, and we'll just start out with House File 1317. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would move House File 1317 to be re-referred to the Environment Committee, and I would move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape I would like.
All right. The A1, discussion to the A1. Hearing none, all those in favor of the A1 say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay. The ayes have it. The A1 amendment is adopted. To your bill, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 1317, as amended, has been around at least 2 years, maybe three, but it's been here at least 2 years. And it is trying to resolve the challenge of dealing with treated seed in terms of where does the Department of Ag's responsibility under the seed law end, and where does the Pollution Control Agency's authority as solid waste or waste begin. And when we began this journey, that was unclear. It is still somewhat unclear. I applaud the agencies for preparing a fact sheet, but fact sheets and authority can change over time. And so we are providing for a rulemaking process here where we can have a system that lives on beyond just one fact sheet developed last year. We also take under Section 2, pesticide treated seed, this language comes from the University of Minnesota guidance, their fact sheet, on how not to dispose of pesticide treated seed. It provides later in terms of the violations and a caution statement. So using education, and I'm fully aware of what a label and labeling are. We are not changing the label or labeling, but we're providing a caution statement stating so that folks who may not know that planting seed treated with a neonicotinoid pesticide may negatively impact pollinator health. Please use care and handling when planting this seed. So it's kind of like a cigarette warning label on a package that provides information. So there's awareness. There's not a penalty for that, but there's awareness for that so that folks who are planting the seed may be aware that it might have an impact. And this is the result of multiple peer-reviewed published information about treated seeds having an impact on pollinators, particularly native bees, particularly bumblebees, and the impacts of them in the spring. It provides that the Commissioner of Ag, working with the Pollution Control Agency, work together. It has a definition of waste-treated seed. So this is something that's no longer going to be used, prohibits disposal methods, and has the rulemaking. And it provides an appropriation. I'd ask for your support.
All right. I see that we have the A2 amendment. Who is offering the A2? Representative Anderson to the A2.
Thanks, Madam Chair. The A2 deals on the page 3, line 26, impacting farmers, and I think there'd be a little bit more comfort if the regulations concerning the disposal of seed and the regulatory jurisdiction had approval from the MDA rather than simply consultation. So all this amendment does is say that the MPCA, when they do their rulemaking, it must be approved by the Department of Ag instead of just being consulted with. And I would hope it would be a friendly amendment.
Discussion. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Anderson, I regret to say it's not friendly, but I think that the agencies are friendly with each other, and they're in the same administration that they can work with each other. And with rulemaking, there'd have to be that public process of the two agencies working together. So in consultation with the Department of Ag would be there. I think it's somewhat unusual to require a second step of approval from another agency within the same administration. So I'd ask for a no vote on the AQ. But I understand what you're saying. I would hope that agencies can work together, and it would be in a public process where they do work together.
Representative Anderson? All right. Further discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay.
Nay.
The nays have it, and the motion does not prevail. The A2 amendment is not adopted. We'll move on to testifiers. Chris Cohen from the Pesticide Action Network, if you can identify yourself before the committee and keep it under 2 minutes. And then we'll also have Judy Wu over Zoom. We'll start with Chris.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Chris Cowan, and I'm a lobbyist, contract lobbyist with the Pesticide Action Network. I will try to talk as fast as I can. In your packets, there should be a piece of paper that looks like this. It says, this is a memo. And what I'm addressing here by asking folks to look at this memo is part of the nexus of where this all came from. In 2021, it was discovered that the treated seed in a lot of the country that was unused was going to an ethanol plant in Mead, Nebraska to make ethanol, and then those folks were attempting to sell the byproduct, which was highly toxic. So let me just read here this is an email from the Alton Ethanol Plant advertising what they do. Greetings from Alton in Mead, Nebraska, the seeds industry's number one choice for recycling treated and regulated seeds in North America. Alton uses the discarded product to produce ethanol, and all products are put through an anaerobic digester, and all products are applied under the state of Nebraska EPA permit and allowance by the USDA. Well, my understanding that this was operating legally in the state of Nebraska for several years until they shut it down and then made it against the law. If you're looking at this piece of paper, you go down to the fourth point. Alton is currently receiving nearly 98% of all the discard created by the seed industry in North America. We are under long-term contracts by all the major producers, such as Monsanto, Bayer, Syngenta, Dow, AgReliant, and Land O'Lakes. We receive discard from at least 100 producers across North America annually. Alton is now offering this very same program to every seed producer in North America. So I'll skip ahead here to a recent article in the Lincoln Journal Star, who, along with the Omaha World Herald, has been covering this very closely. And I'll just highlight a couple of comments made by David Kozad, the director of the EPA Region 7 Enforcement and Compliance Insurance Division. We have a fundamental principle that we operate under, that we are working on this kind of site, and that polluters should pay, not the taxpayers.
He goes on to say that. If you can please wrap up your comments.
I'll wrap up quickly. I just want to point out that the companies that I named at the beginning as being under long-term contracts are now the six companies claiming in court that they've spent so far $28 million cleaning up the site. Thank you for your time.
Judy Wu, if you can identify yourself before the committee and keep it under 2 minutes.
Thank you. My name is Dr. Judy Wu Smart. I'm a professor at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. I want to first thank Representative Hansen and the committee for this opportunity to testify. I'm acting in my own personal capacity and not as a representative of UNL. I testified the past 2 years regarding feed losses that were mentioned before, experienced because of the systemic pesticide pollution caused by a facility improperly disposing of treated seeds through ethanol production. My colleagues and I have since found detectable levels of neonicotinoids and fungicides in surface and groundwater samples, as well as frog tadpoles and in the eggs of blackbirds that live near the facility and near farms where the contaminated byproducts were land applied as soil conditioners. Even worse is the detection of elevated pesticide levels in the air outside and inside the homes and near homes near the plant, even though the facility has been closed for about 2 years now. We are at a point now where we're trying to determine what all this information means. These types of pesticides are not considered to cause cancer and not known to bioaccumulate in tissue like other hazardous substances. Therefore, there are no clear endpoints to delineate what are safe levels of exposure. The levels of neonics found in residential homes are unfortunately within levels that laboratory studies of rabbits and rats show symptoms and physiological changes. Some of these symptoms listed are minor, like changes in weight or respiratory issues, which may not constitute immediate concerns. However, other studies indicate potential impacts on reproductive functions, as well as the health of developing children. Given the range of severity of these symptoms due to associated with exposure, knowing what levels are considered harmful would be very helpful for communicating results and providing the public with some appropriate context. Nebraska state officials and the EPA has not been able to bring clarity on this even after 2 years. Think about that for a moment. Imagine if you were told the air you breathe inside your home or the water you drink has detectable levels of pesticides, but you're not provided any information on what that may mean for the health of your family, nor what to do about it. Pesticide overloading from multiple sources and chemical types, as it is in the case of Nebraska, has created, quote unquote, too much complexity and uncertainty to rule out potential adverse harm to the environment and humans. This is how EPA has responded to our situation.
Unfortunately, Ms. Wu, if you can please wrap up your testimony.
Of course. Unfortunately, this is not strictly a Nebraska problem. There are commonly detected neonics in humans, wildlife, and a lot of the foods we eat. This lack of knowledge regarding the use, movement, persistence, and spread and toxicity are real concerns. And these bills, HF 1317 and 2472, seek to provide more clarity and resolve these uncertainties. Thank you.
All right. Discussion to the bill. Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, I'd like to have MDA come up and tell us if they have already developed guidance to deal with these treated seeds. I'm under the understanding that they and the MPCA in the past year did develop guidelines, and any new guidelines would not be necessary.
If you can please identify yourself before the committee, proceed.
Hi, I'm Denise Thied. I'm the section manager for the seed, noxious weed, hemp, and biotechnology programs at the Department of Ag. And yes, we did work with the MPCA to develop a fact sheet outlining the options available for disposing of treated seed.
Representative Anderson.
No further comments.
Any further comments? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if you look on page 3, before we close 3.4 and 3.5, it is more than doing the rulemaking. It says you may not use treated seed for use as food, feed, oil, or ethanol feedstock, any seed treated with neonicotinoid pesticide. So there is a prohibition in here that does not exist in current law. And again, I misspoke a little earlier. Yes, I didn't. My glasses weren't quite tight on, but Section 7 is what came from the University of Minnesota, where their guidance on disposal methods we make prohibited. And it's pretty simple. It says, may not dispose of waste-treated seed, burial near a drinking water source or any creek, stream, river, lake, or other surface water, composting or incinerating within a home or another dwelling. So those are prohibitions. I ask for your support for the bill as amended and renew my motion.
Right. Representative Hansen renews their motion the House File 1317 as amended be referred to the Environment Committee. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
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 Those opposed say no.
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 The ayes have it. And the motion prevails. The House File 1317 as amended is referred to the Environment Committee. And with that, we'll do the final, the House File 2472. In the next available hearing, which we will try to post in advance.
once we have that figured out. And with that, thank you, members, for staying a little bit over time. And with that, the meeting is adjourned.